And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
Well, today I'm going to answer another 12 of the questions that came out of the AAII presentation, New York City. In my particular case, I presented on the case for small cap value, the good, the bad, and the ugly. If you haven't heard that, then we'll have a link to that certainly in the notes. Now, Chris Pedersen also recorded a piece focused on the two funds for life, basically really focusing after retirement. And he has been on an extended trip, and we'll get to some questions when he's back in town. So let me share some what I think are some great questions here that came from the group. The first one is an easy one, and they ask, if I have a pension and Social Security, can I stay in 100% stocks for a longer period of time? And if I read between the lines, what we're talking about here is somebody who their cost of living is covered by Social Security and a pension. And I've run into this many times during my career, certainly as an advisor. And when you have a situation like that, in essence, the investments are either for some future unknown expense, or let's say an expense that was greater than anticipated, could be a health expense that could be abnormally large, but that without that unexpected expense, the money is generally going to go to either children or charities. And so, in essence, I think the investor has the ability to take as much risk as they and their spouse are willing to take. Now, having said that, there are a lot of people, and myself included, where there's a reasonable amount of money that really isn't for Suzanne and myself, but rather for the kids and for charity. We certainly know that Western Washington University will be able to put some of that money to work, but the bottom line is that we could be in more equities than we are, and I choose not to, and Suzanne goes along with it simply because I don't want to see what is our life savings go down more than a certain amount. But to the extent that you don't need the money to live on, an all equity portfolio is just fine. And of course, I would be recommending, rather than having all the money in the S&P 500, I would certainly want to see it divided amongst a number, at least four different equity asset classes. And that would be some small, some value, some large value, as well as some large growth. So I hope that addresses that question adequately. The second question is from an investor who would like to create their own do-it-yourself target date fund using one of our Sound Investing portfolios. And they could, in theory, use any number of the different portfolios. They could certainly use the worldwide four-fund strategy, which would give them both some U.S. and international, some small-cap value, some small-cap blend, some large-cap value, and some large-cap blend, all contained within four funds. And of course, we give you the names of those funds. You could also use the all US four fund strategy. I also think that it would not be inappropriate to use the two fund with the S&P 500 in small cap value. And finally, depending on how big this account is going to be compared to the rest of the portfolio, if you don't have value elsewhere in the portfolio, you could use the worldwide five fund all value portfolio. And then, of course, you're going to have to match that up with a certain amount of fixed income. And I want to make an important point here about the do-it-yourself target date fund. If we have a young investor, and let's say they're in their 20s, and if they went into a traditional target date fund at Vanguard or Fidelity, you would end up with 10% of your portfolio in that fund for the next up to 20 years, certainly until you're 40 years of age and approximately 25 years away from retirement. Now, that is one big advantage. That would probably add about 0.5% to the portfolio during that first 20 years. Then the other thing you have going for you, if you're putting together a do-it-yourself portfolio, is you're going to have, with a traditional target date fund, almost all of the equities, whether it's U.S. or international, is going to be large cap blend. And that would have an expectation of a 9 to 10% compound rate of return. But with for example, the all U.S. four fund strategy or the 50-50 S&P 500 small cap value, and even the four fund international, and you'd expect a little more out of the five fund all value portfolio, but you'd be expecting probably at least 1.5% better return over that first 20 years from that portion. So between having gotten rid of the fixed income and beefed up the exposure to small and value, you could have as much as a 2% difference for that first 20 years, and that's a big deal. Now, as you get into from age 40 on or 45 on, you're going to start adding fixed income. And let me suggest a real simple way to think about the addition of the fixed income. You could, at age 40, add fixed income for the first time. And you could, every 5 years, add an additional amount. So you don't have to do it every year. You could just add, in essence, between age 40 and age 70, you would have 8 points at which you would add fixed income. Now, if you're going to be a conservative investor, that would suggest that you have, by age 70, probably close to 40% of your money in equities. If you are moderate, we might talk closer to 50. And if we were talking about more aggressive, we might want to have 60% in equity. So the way you can get there, that range, is if every time you reach one of those years, 40, 45, 50, 55, 60, 65, and 70, you move 7% in, that means you will have 56% in fixed income by the time you're 70. If you did the same thing, but you added 6% each time, that would be 48% in fixed income at age 70. And if you did it at 5% increments, you would have 40% in fixed income and 60% in equity, which I think would be a realistic, we'll call it an aggressive posture. My wife and I, we have 50% in fixed income and 50% in equity at age 80. And if you think about it, the management of that account, it's going to be pretty simple. Let's just, for the sake of discussion, say that you took the four-fund strategy, four-fund all-U.S. strategy. Now, that means that you would be dividing that money amongst those four equity asset classes, starting in your 20s or whenever you get started, up to age 40 when you start adding some fixed income. And you could, during the years that you're adding all equities, you don't have to rebalance every year. You could rebalance every 2, 3, even 5 years. And Daryl will be doing some studies on that, hopefully between now and the end of the year. And question number 3. This has to do with taxes, and the question really has to do with the tax implications of the different portfolios that we recommend. Now, depending on how much flexibility you have, depending on how conservative you want the portfolio to be, certainly in a taxable account, the S&P 500 is likely to be the most tax efficient. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, the small cap value, since you're using an exchange traded fund, has a relatively low taxable implication. But once you get into the large cap value, you're going to find there's more turnover. You're going to find that there are more dividends. With the S&P 500, you have very little turnover, but you do have some dividends. And so you would find, for example, for the S&P 500, according to Morningstar, you lose about 0.38% to taxes with the S&P 500. And this assumes that you're in a high tax bracket, by the way. It would be less if you were in a lower tax bracket. And with small cap value, about 0.68. But by the time you get into large cap value and some of the international indexes, the taxes go up more. So I think that if you're satisfied with that combination of the S&P 500 and small cap value, that is going to have a relatively low tax impact. And question number 4. It's a personal question. They want to know whether I own any individual securities within our portfolio. And the answer is no. Now, it's no for a couple of reasons. One is we don't manage the portfolio. We have somebody else take care of that. We know they're going to use index funds for the buy and hold portion. We know that we're going to have the right amount of fixed income to address our downside sensitivities with the buy and hold. And then we have a portion of the portfolio that uses market timing. And there, for sure, I don't want anything to do with maintaining that. But the people who do that work for us, not only do I not want to have any individual securities, that is not their area of expertise. As a matter of fact, they would say that it is, when I say a crapshoot, I don't mean to suggest that it is just a big gamble. But there is no reason to think that their stock-picking abilities would be any better than mine, and I would happen to know that mine are not any good at all. So no, I don't have any money not only invested in individual securities, but I don't have any money invested for fun, for the drama, for the hope that something that I might have chosen did well and that I might take some credit for it having done well. Well, my view is, even if it did well, it wouldn't be because of me. It would, in essence, be because of luck. I do remember when one of my kids was interested in GameStop stock, asked me what I thought about it. Just for fun, I checked with the holdings at DFA, Dimensional Funds, and they had what was a relatively sizable position in it, not because they had anything to do with the short squeeze that went on that took the stock from $10 a share to over $300, but because it was a value company. And so they sold that stock at over $300 a share, supposedly, which means that my wife and I benefited from that. A small amount, I'm sure, because our portfolio is made up of over 12,000 different companies. But no individual companies for me. And boy, do I like question number five, because I think it's a question a lot of people have, and the answer has to do with so many emotions and forces and the nature of your portfolio. But the question revolves around when to take the money from a professional manager charging you some fee and taking it over on a do-it-yourself basis. What is that moment of truth? Well, there could be a whole bunch of moments of truth. First of all, is the question, I think, are you taking this over? Are you an individual without any involvement with anybody else with this portfolio, so that to the extent that you take it on, you're only having to worry about taking it on for you and not a spouse, for example. And that's a big deal, because you may feel qualified, but your spouse might remember that the one time you did get involved, you became very emotional and had a lot of worries, and they may not be in favor of that, because they may be concerned about you getting back into that anxiety mode that you might have been in before. But if you think about it, we know that nobody knows what the market's going to do. We know the range of returns, whether it's by the year or 5 years or 10 years, and there is no way to know what that return might be for the next year or 5 or 10. So there's nothing more that your advisor knows than you know. Now, what they may have found out about you is they may have found out anecdotally that when the market is down 20 or 30%, that you get really antsy, even though you said you were willing to go down 40 or 50. And that could be you getting antsy at 20% when you said 30, or 10% when you said 20. That advisor may have a sense of your limits that may be a little different than what you have actually told them, but they watch how you act as the market goes down. But to the extent that you can figure out, this is what our fine-tuning tables are about. My wife and I know that our portfolio, 50-50 stocks and bonds, is likely to go down 20 to 25% in a bad year along the way. Now, we're both in the latter years of our life, and in my case, another 10 years would be a really great life for me, and it could be that there won't be any 20 to 25% loss, but we've kind of decided that that's the limit, and that would suggest, from everything I know going back over 50 years, that's a 50-50 portfolio, 50% stocks, 50% bonds. And that means that we both need to sign off on that. That isn't just something that I can make a command decision. And so to the extent that we were going to do this ourselves, I'd want to make sure that Suzanne would feel comfortable that we're going to accept the same losses. Now, this is an interesting aspect. I would not be surprised if I took it on that she might have a slightly different feeling about the risk tolerance. Now, where does that come from? Well, it may be that she sees Tyler, our investment advisor, as being more level-headed than I. Or maybe because he's in the business day to day, she may feel like he's closer to what's going on. Well, of course, he can't be any closer if he agrees that he doesn't know where the market's going to go. And you can't have it both ways. You either don't know or you think you do know. And if you do know, the question is, what are you going to do about it? What are the conditions under which you would then somehow change the position? It's a thorny question because it forces people to decide, are you really a buy and holder? So this idea of taking it over yourself it's more than just knowing your risk tolerance. For a lot of people, they have no problem walking across a 2x4 that is on top of a couple of pumice blocks for 10 steps. But if you put that 2x4 between two buildings and it's a two-story fall from where the board goes across, you're not going to be comfortable walking across that with that 2x4, even though you'd be comfortable if it were only a couple feet off the ground. Well, the same thing happens with the size of a portfolio. Some people are very comfortable managing $100,000, but a couple million dollars, and to take the responsibility, even though they would agree nobody knows what's going to happen, there is just something different when you are taking the responsibility or could possibly pull the trigger. Even though you've said I'm a buy and holder and I don't want anybody pulling the trigger, there still is, I think, that emotional tug of war that can go on. Now, the beauty is this, and I, over the years, this worked both ways for me. When I was an advisor, I had a lot of people who really would like somebody else to do it, but they had a hard time trusting somebody else to do it. And so I thought that was easy. Let me manage a part. So if you had other people managing $2 million, then why don't you take $500,000, use the same amount, percentage of equity and fixed income. After all, you've worked that percentage out with the help of an advisor. And you might say, well, okay, that's fine, but when it comes time to make the change, what do I do? Well, there are a couple things you could do. One is you could not only accept a certain combination of equity and fixed income into your financial life today, but you could also accept a glide path. Just like I spoke a few minutes ago, as you reach certain milestones by age or some other way of measuring when you would feel like you have to get more conservative. It might be you could even say, if my portfolio falls below a value of X, I'm going to have to lower my exposure to volatility. There are any number of ways that could be configured. But you could also do something interesting. You might not want to pay somebody 1% to manage that $500,000, and you'd like to save that $5,000. But is it possible that there's somebody out there that would sit with you once a year on an hourly basis and have you consider that one decision, how much in equities and how much in fixed income. Because in theory, your equity position, for example, for Suzanne and myself, we have the same percentages in big, large, big and small, and value and growth, and U.S. and international, that we did a long time ago. The difference is how much we have in fixed income. So you don't have to get out of emerging markets, or you don't have to get out of small cap value because you got older, but maybe you need to be in less equities overall. That would be the important decision. So just understand that what you're going to be left with, if you have chosen equity asset classes and you have chosen fixed income, and then it is to either have a glide path or you have to create it along the way. And number six, I think that Chris may have addressed this. I'm not sure. But it has to do with target date funds and what you add to the target date fund. And Chris has talked about putting away 10% or 20% small cap value with the target date fund. But in this particular case, the question was about combining a 50% position in small cap value and the other 50% in a target date fund. Now, I would certainly be happy with that for a 20-something. I would be okay with that with a 30-something. But once you reach 40 or 45 or 50, when you're going to start adding fixed income, and in the target date fund, we know at Vanguard, they're going to hold 10% fixed income up until you're 40, or let's say 25 years away from retirement, and they're going to add it over the years, and sometimes some change maybe in most of the years. Not big jumps like I had recommended earlier, where you only make a change once every 5 years, which I think is just fine. But they have a glide path, and if you were 50% in small cap value and 50% in the target date fund, it would mean at age 40. You would only have about 5% in fixed income. And that over the years, the target date fund would start to increase its position in bonds, so that theoretically, if you maintained a 50-50 strategy, by the time you were 70 years old, you would have, let's say, half the money in the target date fund. And in that particular portfolio, theoretically, you could have half the money in fixed income, which means that you'd have 25% of the total portfolio in bonds, and it may not be enough bonds for you. Now, I think it would be fine for a lot of investors that they wouldn't want to have any more than 25% in bonds. But the question is really going to be, how are you going to adjust to the need for fixed incomes? Because the target date fund does that automatically. So to the extent that you're going to continue to use this 50-50 strategy for your whole life, then you might want to at some point reconsider how you're going to deal with the fixed income. Number seven, and I'm going to guess that this question kind of flows out of the dollar cost averaging versus lump sum. And the question didn't get into necessarily that's what it's about, but the question had to do with, is there a point at which the market would fall, that you would just, you just jump into the market, put everything into the market. And I believe for people who are struggling with the dollar cost averaging versus lump sum, that it is not abnormal to take the position that, let's say, you're going to dollar cost average in over 12 months or 24 months. But if the market goes down 30% or 20% from a top, that you're going to go ahead and put everything in. That the reason that you did that dollar cost averaging was to protect yourself from having the market collapse immediately after you put the money in. So if it does collapse shortly after you put the money in, at least you will have protected yourself from that eventuality. And I always have to remind people, you can dollar cost average in over 24 months. And during that 24 months, the market can move higher, gently, or radically higher. And it may, at the end of 24 months, after you have finally committed all the money, it is only then that the market decides to collapse. So you never get away from that built-in downside exposure that you're going to eventually have. Because if you say that you're willing, like my wife and I, are willing to lose 20 to 25%, if you say that that's what you're willing to lose, if you started dollar cost averaging in with half of your portfolio, when you finally get to 50-50 stocks and bonds, you are now carrying that risk with you for the rest of your life if you stay 50-50, because it will always have that potential sizable loss built in. By the way, that is not a loss that happens so often, but certainly it has been said that 1 in 15 years, there is a good probability you're going to be exposed to a 30% loss. And question number 8, which is also about dollar cost averaging versus buy and hold, is really it's a different kind of question. And the question is there really likely to be a big difference between a lump sum investment and dollar cost average over time? Yes, there is likely to be a huge difference. And it will depend on luck, because we know what the market has done in the past. And when we have an unusual circumstance that leads to either an amazing buying opportunity or a terrible buying opportunity, you look at something like 1987, where on October 19th, the market fell over 20%, I believe over 22% in one day. That was a terrible time. Or in 73 and 74, there was a 50% decline hidden in there. In 2000 to 2002, there was a 50% decline. 2007 and through early 2009, there was a 50% decline. So sometimes that decline can happen very quickly. Sometimes it happens over extended periods of time. But if you were a dollar cost averager into the small cap value from 1927 through about 1944, you would have made twice as much in small cap value than you would have dollar cost averaging into the S&P 500. And that has to do with the sequence of returns and how volatile those returns were And it was a terribly volatile time, and a lot of that volatility was to the downside. Now, eventually, there had to be volatility to the upside, because when it was all over, it was a profitable period. But dollar cost averaging made a lot more money with small cap value because it had such a terrible time. On the other hand, if you had had a lump sum investment in those two investments in the middle of 1927, by, I believe it was 1944, the returns, while they were positive, were virtually the same. Because when you have a lump sum investment, it doesn't matter when it's good and when it's bad. It just matters that you had years that were up a certain amount and down a certain amount. But when you're putting money in on a regular basis or you're taking money out on a regular basis, the sequence of return becomes so, so important. So for people who are retiring and are going to be taking money out, the thing we worry about is the first 5 or 10 years. We don't want the market to go down significantly in the first 5 or 10 years. Because that can put you behind the eight ball. At the same time, you're taking money out to live on, the market's going down. And those are periods that people could run out of money before they run out of life because they lose the power of growth. But it was just luck, bad luck. But you can have the same good luck. And the good luck is when you're a first-time investor, you don't have any money committed, nothing to lose, you're putting money in and the market's going down and you're gobbling up those lower price shares, just getting ready for the market to eventually go to the upside, which it always has. I'm not talking about one stock at a time, by the way. I'm talking about the market in general. Number 9, I'm sticking my neck out on this one. This is really Chris's bailiwick, but I know that Chris doesn't like to recommend ETFs in between his major recommendations. But the question is there a small cap emerging market value portfolio that we can recommend? Well, I want you to check out AVDV. It is the A Victor, D as in dog, V as in Victor, ADVD. It is an Avantis fund. It is a small to mid cap emerging market fund, not just small, but they are smaller than the companies inside the AVES, which is the Avantis Emerging Market Value Fund for larger companies. So I don't think Chris would fight me on that one, that it is a good fund. Now, whether that will be the fund of choice for him when it comes time to update, I'm not sure, but I feel strongly it is, I know it's in the running. Number 10. This one starts out with a strong statement, and that is that no investment advisor I know recommends you have all your money in small cap value. And certainly I am not a fan of putting all your money in small cap value. Having said that, if somebody put aside the first 5 years of their IRA into small cap value and then just stopped putting money into that investment and left that then to grow, let's say from 25 to 70 years of age, it has the potential of being a huge home run. If you took $6,000 a year for the first 5 years, put that into small cap value, I would hope you would be able to do that inside of a Roth. And then you close the account. I mean, you didn't add any more money, but you left that account to grow for the next 40 years. That total investment of $30,000 would be at a 12% compound rate of return, would be about over $3.5 million. So would I think that's bad? No, I don't think it'd be bad at all. But it isn't me recommending that all of the money that they have to invest is all of the time going into small cap value. I would also be, for part of a portfolio, not be unhappy with the idea of having it be the worldwide all value. I think that will be a fine long-term investment. So I think it's a matter of, for most people, some diversification of different kinds of portfolios with different accounts. People will have a taxable. They'll have a Roth for each of the two spouses. They may have a regular IRA. They may have then a 401k. There are lots of different potential diversification strategies that could be used across an account. Number 11, should I be using tax loss harvesting inside of a taxable account? Well, we don't give tax advice. The good news is that we have truth tellers, what we call truth tellers, who do address these topics in great depth. And the reality is that to give a complete answer would take a lot of time, and I would likely be reading somebody else's work. So I'm going to give you two links to some work from the White Coat Investor that I think you will find helpful in making that decision. Having said that, there are people who think that basically it's a waste of time. But read what Jim has to say. I think you'll find his work, if you are interested in doing this, very helpful. And the last question is one that during that evening on October 11th or 12th, that I did the AAII presentation along with Chris Pedersen. One of the questions came up about an equal weighted portfolio versus a cap weighted portfolio. And I think I misunderstood what the question was about, but I think it's worth addressing. If you looked, for example, at Invesco's S&P 500 portfolio that is equally weighted. Now, by equally weighted, that means that the 500 stocks, and I'm just going to use an example. If they had $100,000 in that portfolio, and they had those 500 companies, that they would have $2,000 in each company, regardless of how big the company might be. Now, if you had that same $100,000 and you cap weighted it, most of the money would end up in a handful of companies that are much bigger. And so they represent a bigger percentage of the portfolio. So when you buy the S&P 500 normally, you get a cap weighted. So Microsoft and Tesla, a handful of companies represent a very major part of the long-term outcome. Now, what happens when you spread the money equally? Well, let's first of all remember that the academics tell us that smaller companies generally make a better rate of return than the growth companies. Well, when you have equal amounts of those 500 companies, you're not overweighting to those powerhouses. You're giving more money to those companies that are smaller and maybe more value-oriented. Well, in fact, would likely have a greater value orientation. So when we look at the last 15 years, there is about a 1% advantage using that Invesco fund with the equal weighting versus the Vanguard S&P 500 index that's been around for that period of time. Now, that's a big deal, but it's not a shock because the reality is you have gotten what the academics said that you would likely get. So how does that relate to your S&P 500 return, or the fund you're going to use, or the ETF you're going to use to represent the S&P 500 or large cap blend? And in fact, while it is not an equal weighted portfolio, we actually use, instead of an exact S&P 500 index, we use in many of our portfolios AV, as in Victor, US. That is a large cap blend portfolio, and it is not run exactly like the S&P 500 on a cap weighted basis, and yet it has produced over the time that it's been around, it has done better even than the Invesco portfolio. Now, I would say that owning that, whether it's AV US or that or the Invesco equal weighted S&P 500 fund, I would say that that is going to take the place in your portfolio of the large cap blend exposure. And you're still going to want to, for example, that is not going to take the place of U.S. small cap value, and nor will it necessarily take the place of large cap value. But I think it is it could be used as a legitimate other asset way to fill your portfolio with that large cap blend asset class. So there you go. Now we've done 24 of approximately 48 questions. Many of the 48 are too specific and probably aren't appropriate for this format. But Chris will come back and we'll address some of the questions that are really specifically, I think, addressed to him. And in the meantime, I hope you are continuing to find value in our work. We've got some really, in fact, this afternoon, I should say this evening, I am going to have, and I don't do this very often, I am going to have a conversation with a grandmother and her children about a special way to help their grandchildren create the kinds of portfolios that I have talked about many times for young people to help them get started with their Roth IRA. And one of the biggest challenges is, what do you do when you have a whole bunch of different ages? How do you try to treat them all equally? Because obviously, there are going to be some major differences in how things will do for them because of that sequence of returns. You know, if you've got one child who, let's say, is 3 years old and one is 15 years old, how are you going to treat them the same? And so I'm meeting with the family, and we're going to try to figure out. I've got an idea, and if it works out, if they agree it's a good idea, I'll share it with you. I'm not going to share the conversation because that'll need to be private, but I will share the outcome of that conversation, and it's not something that I can do on a regular basis, but I think it's important I talk it through with people to make sure I'm not overlooking something that is obvious to make it most workable. So there you go. I've got more fun today to come, and I hope that this work will be helpful to you here today. Thanks for listening, as always.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.